I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week are the Exeter Book Poems. For anyone who, like me, was pretty unfamiliar with the Exeter Book, it is a 10th century English manuscript that at the back features almost 100 riddles. And for a long time, people have wondered what these riddles are about. Who wrote them? What are some of the answers to the riddles? And there are no definitive answers that are included in the book. And that has, over the years, led to a lot of discussion, a lot of speculation and wondering what these riddles mean. Are there definitive answers? And what is their significance? And it is the subject of a new book by Jennifer Neville entitled Truth is Trickiest: The Case for Ambiguity in the Exeter Book Riddles. And in this book, Jennifer argues essentially that there are no definitive answers to these riddles and that that's okay. And this ambiguity that she's arguing for is a good thing, and it allows space for the riddles to exist without having this defined understanding of what they mean. It's a really captivating and persuasive argument that she puts forward. And I should note that I am not an expert on the Exeter Book riddles or even the Exeter Book or Middle English, Old English. These are topics that I was unfamiliar with before coming to the book. And I love doing episodes like this, and I love reading books like this that are based in methodological approaches that are new to me, featuring topics that I'm unfamiliar with. So I really enjoyed coming to this one, learning about the Exeter Book, learning about the riddles, and learning about Jennifer's approach and how she is distinguishing this argument for ambiguity from a lot of the other literature that exists about the Exeter Book riddles. So this is a really fun one for me to record. Really enjoyed speaking with Jennifer. I think you will enjoy this conversation as well. So let's get right into my chat with Jennifer Neville. All right. And Jennifer Neville joins me now. Jennifer, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Doing great. Very excited to talk about Truth is Trickiest, the Case for Ambiguity in the Exeter Book Riddles. And Jennifer, let's start at the basics with this and start with the Exeter Book. So anyone who might not be familiar with Old English poetry, what is the Exeter Book?
The Exeter Book is a 10th century manuscript. It's a pretty big book, a whopping big book. And so in the 900s, one person sat down and wrote out a whole pile of poems in Old English. So it's a really unique book because most other books that we have from the period are usually in prose or a combination of poetry and prose, and most of them are in Latin. So this one's extraordinary in being actually written in English, and it's extraordinary that it's just a collection of poems. And it's held now at Exeter Cathedral, and I understand they have a new exhibition space opening up soon, so people will be able to go and actually see the book, which has been hidden in a cupboard for a while.
Have you ever seen it, like in person? Like, what condition is it in a thousand years later?
Yeah, I have seen it. Only behind glass. I've never actually touched it with my own hands. It's quite a precious thing. So not very many people get their hands on it. What is it? What is it like? It's in pretty good shape, mostly, considering it's over 1,000 years old. Except at the beginning and at the end. So at the beginning, there's a great big stain on it from some kind of liquid that's been spilled on it, which makes the first page of it really quite difficult to read, but it's all there. And then most of the pages after that are beautifully clear and wonderful, and there's no problem at all. There's a couple pages missing, but for the most part that's all right. And then at the end, for the last, I don't know, 8-9 pages or something, there's a great big hole burnt through it.
Ooh.
Right, so when you flip through the book, first of all, you get a little tiny hole, and then you turn the page and the hole's a bit bigger. And then the next page, the hole's a bit bigger till you get the back. And there's like two big burn marks sort of diagonally across it where you've lost maybe a third of the page, a little bit more towards the end. which unfortunately is where my part of the book is.
Right. Yeah. So you said it's one person. How do we know it's one person who wrote this?
Okay. So when I say wrote, I mean physically.
Like transcribed, right?
Physically transcribed, yeah. The book. Yes. So because it's one handwriting all the way through, okay. And it's very good handwriting as well. This is a top quality scribe. We have this person's handwriting in other manuscripts as well, so we can recognize the handwriting. Probably a man, but that's not. I mean, most of the scribes were men. There were some female scribes, so it could have been a woman, but most people assume this was a man. But a really very, very good scribe with lovely, lovely, clear handwriting.
And what would the point of scribing this book have been? This is pre-printing press and pre-mass literacy.
Yes.
So who would he have been doing this for? What would the point of taking all this time to write this material down? Why did he do this?
That's the million-dollar question. Right. So almost certainly this is a monastic environment. So the person is a monk, and Christianity is a religion of the book, and it's all about books and writing. And some of the texts in this book are religious, but some of them aren't. And the question of how were these texts chosen? Who chose them? You know, there's no inscription saying, I wrote this book because Lord so-and-so wanted a poetry collection. There's nothing like that. And some of the poems are clearly devotional and some of them are not. Some of them are quite secular, aimed at an audience outside the monastery. We really don't know. It's quite mysterious. And there's been a lot of ink spilt about relationships between the texts and why anybody would want this. And it would have been expensive. This is a really big investment. This is quite a big book. There's a lot of animals killed to make the skins on which this book was written. A lot of effort creating the ink and everything. I don't know, maybe it's a bit flippant, but I was sort of going like a Lamborghini kind of investment, right? This is top quality stuff. No gold leaf, no illustrations, but still a very good scribe, very, very expensive materials. And yeah, we don't know why.
And the time too, right? Like the amount of time it would have taken.
Absolutely.
To do it as well. Is there any notion as to who the authors of the various poems are, or where this material is coming from, or is that a mystery as well?
That's a mystery as well. All the poems are anonymous. That's not that unusual in this period. Most Old English poems are anonymous. There's only like a couple, two, that have authors. So the rest of them are all anonymous. Beowulf is anonymous. And all the poetry in this book is anonymous as well.
So you mentioned that a lot of it is devotional. Are there any other themes that emerge from poetry in the book and things that come across? Or is it picking just kind of random poems that he likes?
Yeah. There seems to be some relationships between some of the poems. So like the first three poems are all pretty religious and they're focused on the Messiah, on Jesus Christ. And then there's some saint lives about a guy named Guthlac who went into the wilderness and became a hermit and fought against demons and everything. But then after that, the poems get shorter. So they clearly have been organized, right? The longest ones are at the front. And then the shortest ones are at the back. And sometimes they're grouped together. As I said, lots of people have tried to make arguments about what is the meaning of the Exeter book. And I think one of the big reasons for that is because of the riddles at the back, because they raise a lot of questions about what is this book for.
Yeah, so you mentioned the riddles there, and that's really the focus of what the book is the riddles that are at the back. And you said that that's where the damage was, where there's the holes at the back. So how many riddles are we talking about roughly that you're able to look at and study for this book?
Okay, so when we say roughly, we think there probably were 100 riddles. Because we've got some Latin collections and the sort of classic number for a riddle collection is 100. So we've got Symphosius, he had 100 riddles. We've got Aldhelm, he had 100 riddles. We have this guy, Tatwinet, he wrote 60, so someone else wrote 40 to make sure it was 100. So we have about 90 in the Exeter book with pages missing.
Okay.
So we think we're talking, they were aiming for 100, but we've got about 90, 91 that we can still read today.
And yeah, I think for me, and maybe a lot of people who are listening, yeah, I think of riddles as, you know, a cowboy rides in on Tuesday, stays 3 days, leaves on Tuesday. How is that possible sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. What are we talking about in terms of the type of riddle, the style of riddle? How are they written in this era?
Yeah, so they're a lot longer than that for the first for the main thing, and they're really hard to generalize about, because I was going to say they're not jokes, and I'm going, but some of them are. Right. some of them are very serious. Some of them are quite philosophical, and some of them are really long. So, like, the longest one's over 120 lines long. And the pages are missing at the end of it. So it could have been a lot longer than that. And then we've got a couple one-liners. So there's a lot of variety in the subject matter, in the tone, and in the size of them, right? Mm-hmm. But I'd say the main difference between riddles then and riddles now is, first of all, they're much more serious. They're not for kids, and most of them are not a joke. So most of them, even if they're funny, they're more serious than how we take them now. And they usually have a more philosophical kind of import to them.
So you mentioned that this is a tradition that within the Latin tradition about 100 riddles. Mm-hmm. Why did that start? Where does that come from? Where do we start seeing that at the end of books and what was sort of the meaning of putting riddles into these literature collections and as part of poetry?
So where it starts for me, it starts in North Africa.
Okay.
So I mentioned this guy named Symphosius, and that's not his name. That's just the name that gets attached to him. A scholar once said that the name Symphosius basically means party animal. And he's somebody who wrote a collection of 100 riddles. And he says, I was at this party and everyone was telling riddles, so I wrote 100 riddles on the spot to show off. And going like, yeah, right, in Latin hexameters. Yeah. So that's not the start of riddles. And it's quite clear that Symphosius himself was writing within a tradition that goes back to Byzantium and Greek riddles and earlier riddles as well. Right. But for me, my riddling tradition doesn't know anything before Symphosius.
Okay.
So Symphosius has his riddles, and then other Latin riddles wrote that. And then these Old English riddles, some of them are translations of the earlier riddles. Mm-hmm. Some of them are transformations, and then others have no connection at all.
Are there ones that are specific to English and the language? So, you know, ones that might have been new that, okay, they're born out of a Latin tradition, but are specific to time, location, that you can tell that these are written in this moment.
Yes, definitely. And I said even the ones that are translations are transformations. So they all put the ideas that are in the riddles into the poetic idiom of the time. So again, I mentioned Beowulf, that some people have heard of, the style of Beowulf, the verse form of Beowulf, the sort of heroic ethic of Beowulf runs through these riddles as well. They're definitely part of that literary tradition as well.
And stylistically, what are we looking at here? I mean, again, I'm not sophisticated in literature and poems. I think of a poem as like four lines that rhyme, right? Like that sort of, you know, that I'm not like, I don't have a depth of knowledge of this old literature. So if I were to go in and read a couple of these riddles, what would I be looking at just stylistically?
Mm-hmm. Stylistically, well, probably you wouldn't be able to read it because the language changed a lot over the last 100 years. Right. But stylistically, no rhyme.
Mm.
Right. Okay. So this is a verse form that's all based on alliteration. So in every line of the verse, there's going to be two or three words that alliterate with each other. So they're going to have B's or D's or whatever. So that kind of what ties a line of verse together is the sound at the start of the words instead of at the end of the line.
Oh, interesting.
And every line alliterates like that. So and there's a very strict verse form, which is very complicated. And you know, they see when they. And scholars are still arguing about how it works, so I can't explain that to you. But there is a verse form, and nowadays, when we edit it, we sort of try and represent that verse form by dividing each line into half lines. So you'll see a little short bit, gap in the middle, and a short bit. And as I say, you'll have that alliteration that ties the two halves together.
Right. Well, you mentioned the sort of that level of interpretation, this argument of when we write it down. Is there debates on what the words are, or have people tried to take the words from these riddles and put them into more modern English? And is there debate about how we essentially translate it from English 1,000 years ago to modern English?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So the riddles have been argued about for about 150 years now, and there are lots of translations of them, good translations and bad translations. If you go on the internet and search for them, you'll find people having a go themselves now still. So there's still people translating them. And it's, you know, most of the time now you won't find them without somebody having a go at translating them. But because the riddles work through ambiguity, there's a real question when you translate. Do you translate to keep the ambiguity there, or do you try and translate it with the answer in mind?
Right.
So your translation can be quite divisive, actually.
So, okay, let's get into the question of answers with these, yes. Right? And the book is essentially arguing that there is no answers, and that's a good thing, and mm-hmm. that's a positive to it. In the tradition of riddles, was the intent for there to be a singular answer for the most part, for the riddles that come before the Exeter book? Is there this idea that, you know, again, like a puzzle book that you can flip to the back and say, okay, here's the answer. Like, is that part of the tradition of riddles, that there is a singular answer?
Yes. Yeah. So if you look at some of the Latin riddles that are collected, they'll sometimes have the answer as the title. Hmm. So you'll have like a title, and then you'll have the riddle underneath it. Or sometimes you'll have the answer written in the margin. And that's quite common. And there's some older manuscripts where the titles weren't there when the first poet wrote them down, but somebody added them in later. So there was definitely a sense that, yes, there is an answer, and the answer should be there. So not written upside down at the bottom of the page or not at the back, but right there on the page. And there's another Latin poet that I've studied, and he actually encodes the answer by using an acrostic. So if you look at the first letter of each line and you spell it out, it tells you the answer, right? Yeah. Which is very useful, because it means that you don't lose any lines of your poem, right? Because they all have to be there to tell your answer. So the Latin tradition, yes, there's a general expectation that the answers will be there and that they'll be right. That's not to say that they are always right. Sometimes the answers are wrong, or sometimes the answers get changed. But in general, there is an expectation that there is one answer. But then we come to this manuscript, which, as I said, has lots of different kinds of poetry in it. And then we get towards the back of it, and you get these poems, all different lengths. So Symphosiuses are all 3 lines long, right? Some of the other ones are different lengths. The Old English ones are all different lengths. There are no titles. So the original the original scribe, as I told you, is a very good scribe. He's not going to forget something that was there in his original thing. Certainly not 100 times. He didn't write any titles in. But what I think is really exciting is nobody else did either. Nobody else sort of flipped through and went, oh, gee, forgot the titles. Let's just stick them in, or I'll have a go. No titles. There are a few little runic letters written in the margins in 6 places. Mm-hmm. Some of them might have been in the early modern period. But even if they are from the, you know, the 10th century, that's only 6 out of 100. Right. So nobody thought there should be answers here. Mm. And as I say, that's my starting point for my argument for my book, is that they didn't think there should be answers there.
Right. Now, people have argued, as you say, this has been a debate for a long time, but people have argued for singular answers, or have given singular answers to a lot of the riddles, and you include some of these in the book. Why do people think that there are singular answers, or what are some of the common arguments that, oh, this is the answer to this riddle?
I think people come at them thinking about riddles in general. This is how riddles work. And, you know, you get definition. What is a riddle? A riddle is a question with an answer, not an invitation to have a big argument. Whereas I think these riddles are different. And so when people come from other traditions, where they've seen the Latin riddles, where they've got the titles there, they have this expectation. And so they fill the perceived gap that the scribe has left for us. So the scribe's given us the question, but forgotten to give the answer. So we as scholars, we as readers, help him out by adding them. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We assist in that process, mm-hmm. but within that, okay, if there is an idea that, okay, a riddle has a singular answer, why for you, is there a benefit or is there almost the sense that like there's beauty in the fact that there isn't a singular answer written down? And how do you come to these riddles and develop the argument that you have that multiple answers or interpretation is the goal, is the point, and that's where the value in a lot of these riddles comes from? How do you develop that as somebody who I would imagine, just as a human being who has studied a lot in this era and is familiar with singular answers of other riddles, like did you when you started this, did you kind of want there to be single answers? Did you want to like find something in there? And like what is that process from if that's your starting point to okay, no, there is no answer and that's okay?
Well, I don't think there is no answer. I think that there's no end of answer. Right. Mm. So, yes, you're absolutely right. When I first started reading them, I would read other people's solutions and think, oh, yeah, that's great. I believe that. Or that's utterly ridiculous. And I can do better than that. And I'd have a go myself. Or, you know, or I'd read somebody else's and or I'd go like, isn't it interesting that there are seven different solutions here and I can't choose between them? So I started off with that feeling that, yes, there would be one answer. And then I came back to what I've just said earlier, which is the fact is, why didn't the scribe give us the answers if there were answers? And then I started reflecting on that 150 years of scholarship where people have been having so much fun for such a long time, having arguments about it, struggling with it, engaging with it. And this sort of when the riddles are irresistible, you see that blank spot on the page where the answer should be, and you can't help yourself. And I'm sort of going like, the riddles, these texts are really good at making us do things. Mm. And I think that's what led me to this idea that they're so good at bringing us in and forcing us to play the game. Somebody did that on purpose.
Right. Right. So within this, the book gets into, or the riddles get into, a lot of a variety of issues. So the interpretation as they relate to social values, craftsmanship, hierarchical social structures, violence, irony, humor, and sexuality, among others. So how do some of these riddles touch on issues? Are they explicit? Are they all kind of out there and vague and it's left to the interpretation of the reader, I'm curious about how they're worded. So, you know, is there something that is very much a comment on social hierarchies? Like, and do they run the gamut like that, or are they all kind of left to interpretation?
They vary a lot. So, as I said, some of them are really long, some of them are really short, some of them are very particular, some of them only have one solution that's ever been proposed. And some of them have a dozen and people are still arguing about it. So it's really hard. And I think that's part of the game. I think the idea is you sort of start reading the riddles and you think, oh, yeah, I know how these work. This is nature poetry. And it's all about, you know, God's control over the natural world and humanity's place in the natural world. And then you get to the next one and you think, this one's got a master and a slave. And I don't understand how it works. And is this about human relationships or is this an object? And then when you work that one out, you get to the next one and they're going and you're thinking, no, this is not that. All of a sudden now we're playing letter games with runic letters and I don't know what to do with this. So the philosophical content of it and the social commentary comes along the way in many different forms. We're never allowed to get really comfortable and master anything.
Yeah. Right. Over the time that this has been a serious debate, so over 150 years, is the progression or development of answers and the debate over answers, does it reflect the times in which the answers and people are coming up with it. So 150 years ago, as going through Industrial Revolution and the process of that, like, are the answers from that time or the proposed answers from that time reflective of that era? Whereas maybe now people are looking at these riddles from the perspective of the 21st century and some of the challenges that we're facing socially today. Do you see that evolution as you're tracking the way people have addressed and considered and interpreted the riddles?
So everyone's trying, whether it's 150 years ago or now, everyone's trying to put themselves back into the 10th century and answer with material culture that's relevant. So nobody's saying this is a dishwasher. But the sort of social expectations that come around it, I can see that definitely has changed over time. So the easiest example for me is to talk about the idea of sexuality. So Thorpe, one of the first editors of them, when he found the riddles with the double entendre riddles, he just wouldn't translate them.
Oh.
No, not talking about that. Put it down on the page. Move along. We're not talking about that. And then you get about 1910, and they do present them, and they put the Tupper and people like that will say, is like, well, it's just smut. And we're not talking about that, but right. You know, the text is there, they acknowledge that it's there, they translate the words and everything, but they're going like, well, it's just like a failure of taste, you know, at this point, and we'll just try not to think about it. And what I find really fascinating is the kind of generalizations they make. So an example that I've thought about a lot is they say things like, this is the example of sort of lower class humor.
Right.
And that comes back again. So you get moved on later in time and you get somebody in the 80s writing, oh, that's really interesting. They said this is lower class humor, but actually all the people referred to are generally upper class.
Right.
So you see that sort of development over time of people don't want to engage with it. Engage with as little as possible and sort of relegate it to a different social class and then start to think about what it is. And then think about sexuality differently, right? So up until very recently, Riddle 12, for example, which is about masturbation, it's incredible the way they can talk about something without talking about what it's talking about.
Right.
So they're really vague and they talk around it and they talk about social issues of hierarchy and enslavement and Freud. But they really, it's the dodging of the fact of masturbation is quite extraordinary.
Right. And is it the riddles that are explicit and that the interpretation that we'll talk around, or is there some talking around in double entendres in the riddles as well that potentially, again, you mentioned the translations earlier and good translations, bad translations, that if there's vagueness in the originals, that maybe the translations are bad or there are things that were happening then that we just don't know about and can't translate it correctly. Is there a case for that, or is that come up at all?
Yeah, it comes up a lot. And I'm trying to think, there's so many things I was thinking about when you were asking your question, where do I start? The original language was deliberately vague. With the double entendre riddles, it was suggestively vague. I should say that there's only one riddle in the whole collection that is actually about sex. So all the other ones, so there's about 14 or 15, depending on your inclination, seem to be talking about sex, but they aren't.
Okay.
Right. So when you translate them, your language should sound very suggestive.
Right.
But that should be deceptive language. So there's only one riddle that's actually about sex, and that's with chickens.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And not even human sex.
Right. And was that something that was common as well? Did you see a lot of that type of writing in literature or in riddles just generally? So that's very specific to this book?
Yeah, that's the thing. Remember I said this is monastic.
Yeah.
Christianity at the time was the only owner of the technology of literacy.
Right.
And Christianity at the time was very much not in favor of sex. Sex was something you should only do if you really, really had to. And you definitely shouldn't talk about it.
Right.
Yeah. You don't encourage them. Right. That's right. The idea. Very negative about sex. And so, no, in other texts, like in Beowulf, for example, I dare you to find an instance of sex in Beowulf. This sex is not talked about. And so you have this silence about sex and sexuality. And then you've got this riddle book where you've got these texts that seem to be talking about sex. They aren't, but the language that they use to describe this thing that isn't sex is very sexy indeed.
Right. And what does that tell us then about the scribe and maybe what the intended audience was? Does that put that context into the book that he's just trying to be subversive in some way and he's trying to get stuff over on the church or the forces that are trying to limit this type of discussion?
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. We'd love to have some notes with somebody who said to us, well, you know, of course, this is what I'm trying to do. But no, we don't have anything like that. So we've got, again, really good scholarship that talks about how this is a trap for the unwary, that this is a way of trying to test monastic writers and see whether or not they can control their urges when they read this stuff. Right. I don't know. It doesn't quite feel right for me. For me, I think this is an invitation to really work hard at interpretation. Right. And so that the sexual content is part of the challenge that's put before, in this case, probably monastic readers, but any kind of reader would have to deal with this. What do I do with this language? We're not supposed to be talking about this.
Right. Yeah. Now, human beings, I sort of alluded to this earlier, I feel like have a need to know. We want to know everything. Mm-hmm. That's been the core of, say, like the afterlife and questions about religion, right? People, you want to know. There are great unknowable questions in this world, mm-hmm. but we want to know what the answers are. And these riddles kind of fit into that, or you're arguing that there is no singular answer to it. But how much of that desire, that human desire of needing to know, has driven the interest in the riddles? The fact that there is no easy answer, that it is vague, like how much has that maybe led to the longevity of these riddles and the fact that people are still arguing about them and still going back and forth over them 1,000 years later?
Yeah, no, I definitely think it's part of their appeal now. And what's interesting, though, is that about 30 years ago, the riddles weren't that interesting to people, not to scholarship anyway, because they were seen as trivial and not serious. Now they're considered a serious topic within the field of Old English literature. But before that point, the only people who talked about them were people who had a bonkers new idea for a solution to riddle 39, right? You know, but I think, as you say, this desire, human desire to know, when we're faced with something that we can't know, I think that is part of the riddle's appeal. But it's just interesting that up until recently, scholarship wasn't playing the game anymore, but I think the game was real, and I think it still works now. That's the extraordinary thing, that is still working on us now, even though most of us don't know our agricultural implements well enough to play the game properly. But we still feel that desire and that challenge, right? What do you do when you don't know?
Right. And what has changed, do you think, within the scholarship, within the field, to have people come back to them? Like, you know, you've written a book here about the riddles, and what has changed to make them let's say in vogue again, or whatever, that people are coming back to them a little bit more?
Yeah. I mean, there was always sort of a trickle of, as I said, people having a go and doing that, but always just short articles because, you know, you just write your defense of your solution and then you're done. I think what changed is people started realizing that there were social issues going on in these texts as well. And when people didn't write about them because the riddles are short, and once people started engaging with, once they got past that drive to answer it.
Right.
Yeah. And again, that's part of what I'm talking about in the book, that the reason there are no answers there is because the authors of the text want us to do more than just answer.
Right.
And to do that, they have to make us strive to answer for longer. Is when you strive to answer and you strive to re-answer and you strive to defend your answer, then you have to look at the texts in a different way. It's a real, people talk of them as educational texts, and I think that's right, but not sort of like to learn your letters or to learn your arithmetic, but sort of almost intellectual training.
Right. It almost feels like, as you're speaking, that these are historical texts that are almost there to get people to examine society and mm-hmm. to understand what's going on at the time. And from your understanding of it, is this very much a window into life 1,000 years ago, that to understand or to try to interpret the text, to try to come up with answers when people are having to go at their answers, do you have to do in-depth research into this era to actually come up with a plausible, feasible answer?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's always been the attraction for me, I think, is like to write a book about the riddles. I had to learn about birds. I had to think about different species of swans. I had to check out the difference between a plow and an ard, because I didn't know. And, you know, I don't work the land, so I don't know these things. So yes, it definitely is a kind of doorway into the material culture of the time. It's absolutely fascinating. And there is a real pleasure in, you know, it's just a little text and it's talking about a bird, and then then the poet knew everything about that bird.
Right.
And to really appreciate what the poet's done to make a riddle about the bird, you've got to find out as well.
Yeah. Were the riddles or the book in general, how formative were they within the overall English poetry field? Like, you know, obviously the book's still there. It's important. It's 1,000 years later. But was it a formative piece? Did the people who follow go along with similar formats? Or obviously the riddles are very unique, but is this a formative piece of work as the Exeter book and the riddles in particular?
Interestingly, there's a real break. And this is something that I'm going to try not to overemphasize, because lots of scholars recently have been saying that the break isn't entirely real, but there's a real 1066 Norman conquest. It's not that English stops at that point, but English starts changing. English is affected by French. And one of the things that changes quite abruptly is that this poetic style that we have in the Exeter book, this alliterative line and everything, doesn't quite disappear, but almost, right? So when you get to Chaucer, they can't read Old English anymore, and they're not using the same poetic forms. They've adopted forms from Italy and from France, and they've developed new English forms and everything. They're not using the same form anymore.
Right.
And for a long time after that, people couldn't read the literature, and so they weren't copying it. And then in the 20th century, poems like W.H. Auden, poets like W.H. Auden rediscover Old English and fall in love with it. Manley Hopkins falls in love with it, and it's the influence of the Old English poetry comes back in then. So there is a gap in between.
Right.
People rediscover Old English in the 19th, 20th century, and they love it, and they create new art from it then.
Which is very, very interesting.
But not a continuous tradition, right? There is a break there, but it is fascinating how it's come back. Yeah.
Is Old English, are there things within Old English that make it easier or potentially harder to express things, to have this alliterative style or whatever style you want to write in? Like, for anyone who, like me, who's never read Old English, and as you said, I probably wouldn't be able to because it is so different. Like, what are are there parts of Old English that lend themselves towards this form?
The alliterative form.
Yeah.
Yeah,
or the riddles, or really anything, really. Like,
yeah. Well, as I said, one of the many interesting things about Old English poetry is that it's all written in the same form. So the meter of Beowulf is the same as the meter of the riddles. Pretty much, almost all poetry is written in the exact same meter. And the poetic language, one of the great resources it has is this huge pool of similes for various things. So the poetry has 20 words for man. And a huge range of words for wars, and lots of words of interesting, like ordinary words and fancy words and compound words and metaphorical words for the sea, for example. So the it's easier to write alliterative poetry, because if you need alliteration on D, you've got your word hoard right. with all these different words. Whereas in modern English, we tend to run out of words for sword after a while.
Yeah, that's true. We do. So for anyone who's going to come to this book and pick it up, you have a blog on U of T Press where you kind of make the case for the book and why you wrote it and what you hope people get and come out of it. But I'm just curious, for anyone who picks it up, what can they expect? And you've touched on a little bit, but the value of studying these riddles in 2025, why do they continue to be relevant? And the argument that you're making of multiple answers and that there isn't a singular answer for each riddle, how does that really speak to us in this moment? And how does it allow us to potentially understand the riddles within the context of when they were written?
Wow. That's about 12 questions there.
Yeah, I know. I'm so sorry. I know.
So if you picked up the book, what would you find? First of all, I provide translations of all the texts in there. So what you'll find if you thumb through the book is you'll find the Old English texts so you can see them. I quote them at length and everything. You can see them. You can try and read them yourselves. And then you'll have my translations down below. You'll also see lots of places where I tell you what other people have said about them, especially when they disagree with me. So I try to give a really good sense of the argument and the plurality of it. What else will you find? I've done a lot of work trying to get that material culture aside. So there will be some points where I'll go like, now you need to learn about how to make wooden cups, right? And what a wood lathe, what a pole lathe is. So there's lots of that kind of invitation to understand the material culture. So you'll learn quite a lot about the material culture of the time. What else will you get? So I talk a lot about the social structures of the time period, about relationships of hierarchical authorities, about men and women, about the way. So if you're interested in that sort of historical social stuff, there's quite a lot of that in there too. Why would anyone in 2025 want to be looking at it now? It's just great poetry. Oh, it's just wonderful. Why wouldn't you want to read a fantastic text like this, which is so just beautiful? So there's that. Everyone should always be reading beautiful poetry at all times, I think. In terms of my argument about ambiguity and irresolution, As you've said, we want to know, we want certainty, but the world is not certain. Right. And this is a book about being invited to indulge in your search for certainty and to learn how to deal with it when it's not going to, you're not going to get to an ending point. You have to always be prepared for the fact that once you've come up with your perfect answer for Riddle 39, somebody else across the table says, yeah, but what about that, and wouldn't this be better? And I think that at any time period, but you know, I mean, right now I think about the uncertainty that we're facing in the world, this idea that this has been presented to me, I need to question it, I need to approach it, I need to accept it, and then not, and then think about it again and interpret it again. That sort of call for flexibility and call for interrogation, I think, is useful right now.
Yes, totally agree, and very well said. So certainly, I would encourage people to check it out. It is Truth is Trickiest, The Case for Ambiguity in the Exeter Book Riddles. Jennifer, if people want to pick up a copy of the book, what's the best way for them to do that, or just to keep up with everything that you have going on, your other books, just in general, keep up with the literature of Old English poetry?
If they want the book, you can type my name. This is really exciting for me. I feel famous. You type my name into Google and Truth is Trickiest, and it'll go straight to Toronto, and you can order the book from the University of Toronto Press there. How to keep up with old English things. There's a journal called Early Medieval England and Its Neighbors, which is publishing the latest research on the field. Lots of stuff about material culture there. Colleague of mine, Megan Cavell, has a wonderful website called The Riddle Ages. where you could go and look at not only the Old English riddles with translations and commentaries, but also all the Latin ones as well. Right. So I recommend
that. And a great
that.
Name for a website too.
Yes, exactly. I wish I'd thought of it.
Yeah. So, and we will link in the show notes to the U of T page, the U of T press page for the book. So certainly encourage everybody to check it out. Jennifer Neville, thank you so much for joining me today and dealing with the sun in your face in your office there. So I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
So there you have it, my chat with Jennifer Neville. And again, truth is trickiest, the case for ambiguity in the Exeter Book Riddles. And I thank her for her time. So with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from The New Republic on November 7th, 2018, from Joe Livingstone, entitled, "What Do Our Oldest Books Say About Us? On the Ineffable Magic of Four Little Manuscripts of Old English Poetry." And in this article, Joe goes through and looks at the Riccelli book, Junius manuscript, the Exeter book, and the Beowulf manuscript. And Joe talks about why these manuscripts are so important and so meaningful, partly because the originals still exist. And by seeing them in person, you have the opportunity to engage with literature in a form that doesn't exist anymore, in a world in which mass literacy did not exist. There's no printing press. This is a literary moment that is so different from the literary moment we live in today, with mass production of literature, widespread literacy. It's a very different environment in which literature exists in the 21st century compared to 1,000 years ago. And so Joe goes through these books, goes through the experience of seeing the books and just how remarkable it is that they exist, and that even though the language is very different from what we would use today, we can understand what they're saying. There's an ability to translate from that Old English to modern English, and that we can engage with what people were writing and those who could read were reading back 1,000 years ago. And while the text might still exist and can exist in other forms, you can find the text of these books online, the tangible physical objects are of great value, and they can change the way we engage with them. And one wonders what in 500, 1,000 years from this digital era, what will be left and how much is going to be lost from what is produced today. It's an interesting thought experiment moving forward. I know a lot of archivists consider that and how we are going to confront the digital archive. What do we keep? What don't we keep moving forward? So this is a ode really to these books and the value of them in their tangible physical form. So part essay, part news article, but probably leaning a little bit more to the essay, but really enjoyed going through it and certainly would recommend you check it out. So today's historical headline of the week from The New Republic, Joe Livingstone, "What Do Our Oldest Books Say About Us? On the Ineffable Magic of Four Little Manuscripts of Old English Poetry," from The New Republic, November 7, 2018. And with that, I will say thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe. Where you get your podcast, like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show. Keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all the great written material on the site. And of course, as always, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, it's oldasnews@gmail.com. So again, thank you for listening. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old is News.